From the Theater Talk studio at WBFO, I'm Mark Scott, and this is Press Pass with Buffalo Spree editor Elizabeth Licata.
Hello, Mark.
Hi there. Buffalo's Hamlin Park neighborhood is an historic city neighborhood adjacent to Canisius College that seems to be a place where people want to live. We'll get to why in a moment. The May issue of Buffalo Spree, arriving in subscribers' mailboxes this week, profiles Hamlin Park, and we begin with a little history. It's named after a family that once had a horse racing track in that neighborhood. Tell us more about that.
The Hamlin family is fascinating. They also had a horse racing track in East Aurora, and then had this horse racing track there. And also there's the Hamlin House on Franklin Street, which is now the Troop I American Legion Post, was built by Chauncey Hamlin for his family. So their name is spread throughout Western New York. They were very instrumental in founding the Science Museum. So really a very important Western New York family, descendant of which of one is Harry Hamlin, who is one of the Hamlin family descendants.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And I did not know the link between Hamlin House and Hamlin Park. Now I know. Thanks.
Yes.
The neighborhood was devastated, along with other nearby neighborhoods, in the late 1950s by the decision to build the Kensington Expressway, the stately elm and maple trees that stretched along Humboldt Parkway were brought down, and the rest is history. Why do you think Hamlin Park, though, was able to survive when other nearby neighborhoods deteriorated in the wake of the Kensington Expressway?
Well, they immediately sort of coalesced as a neighborhood, as a community, really, and decided we're going to keep our neighborhood. Our neighborhood is going to stay strong despite this. And they're still trying to undo the damage of having that highway splitting up a neighborhood as it did, and of course Delaware Park, and I mean all kinds of damage that's been done there. But they are a very strong community. They have a strong taxpayers association, and they take care of their homes. And you know, that's the main thing, is just to stick together, to take care of your homes, to look out for your neighborhood, to call the, you know, to use the city when you can, and keep an eye on what's going on.
Well, from what I've read, people want to live there.
Yes.
Because it's near Metro Rail. It's near parks. The museums aren't all that far away. And most of all, as you mentioned, the homes are in good shape and are owner-occupied.
Owner-occupied and historic, and as you can tell in the article, very lovely homes and architecturally interesting. I've been interested in Hamlin Park for a long time because actually Mark Goldman, the historian and former restaurateur, wrote an essay for me about Hamlin Park back when I started with Spree in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, I've been paying attention to it. And then I noticed that one of my writers, Mike Puma, had bought a dollar house there. And so I've been after various writers to, like, let's do something on Hamlin Park. And longtime Spree writer Phil Nyheis took up the challenge.
Nice article. It certainly is a diverse neighborhood. All ages, young and old now, African-American.
All races, all ethnic groups. A really interesting neighborhood.
And it's on the National Register of Historic Places. How did that come about?
Well, I think the being on the Register of Historic Places is very useful for a neighborhood. It's what we call in the preservation community the carrot as opposed to the stick, which is the city historic preservation neighborhood. If you're on the National Register of Historic Places, you have access to various tax rebates and so on when you do make remediation and renovations on the exterior of your home. So it's something that you kind of go after because, unlike the city where you don't really get fined for doing things that are not according to preservation law, you really are just getting helped when you restore your home according to preservation law.
And it sort of came about surrounding the controversy of the old St.
Yes.
Vincent de Paul Church. Canisius acquired it, wanted to demolish
it. That's right.
And the neighborhood said no. And now that former church is a wonderful space, performance space, for Canisius. So it really worked out for both.
Yes, and that fight took place a long time ago before the current sort of tax help came along through being a historic space.
Well, you mentioned the Kensington Expressway, and there are proposals to cap it, mm-hmm. make it a tunnel of sorts with greenery on the top. But there are those who want to fill it in mm-hmm. and return traffic to the arterials, Genesee Street, Sycamore Avenue, Broadway.
Bring it right back to the way it was before rather than just sort of do the window dressing. Who knows what's really going to happen? I mean, to many of us, it seems incredible that one would make that highway somehow go away. But it's been done. They did it in Boston, and other things have happened in Buffalo that no one thought would happen, such as the Richardson building being restored, such as, you know, a lot of other so-called impossible things have happened. So there is hope but I think that it's restoring the neighborhood that people care about the most, and simply capping it won't do that.
But given the amount of traffic that we see on the Kensington Expressway each day, could the arterials handle that kind of volume?
Oh, I think they could. I go back and forth to work without taking a highway. I mean, this is within the city proper that we're talking about. And once they, you know, the 198 basically became no longer a highway, right? So a lot of us just don't take it anymore. It doesn't make any difference to our time. It's within the city that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Coming in from the suburbs, no one's suggesting, I don't think, that we remove the 33, you know, from the airport to the, you know, yeah. to the city line. No one's suggesting that.
Yeah. Scar.
Exactly. And by the time they get, you know, to say downtown or wherever they enter the city, they disperse and you go to your various places where you need to be. I honestly don't think it'd be that big of a deal. Buffalo does not have what I would call a traffic problem, not even close. The amount our commutes are so short, I think that's kind of a specious argument.
And perhaps it could result in the revitalization of some deteriorated areas. Genesee Street's not pretty. If traffic is going up and down there and businesses pop up, who knows what could happen?
Well, and I think these highways helped perpetuate an east-west divide in the city that nobody wants anymore and that we all want to get rid of, so that we're redeveloping our entire city as a whole, not just parts of it.
Well, let's move on to the May special section, this one focusing on the trend toward small plate offerings at area restaurants. And just what is considered a small plate?
Well, I think now a lot of the restaurants that you go to will actually have a small plates menu called just that. It used to be called the appetizer menu. I'm seeing much more small plates. And that's basically what they are, is appetizers. And it's not a ton of food. And a lot of people are just having a couple small plates and not even moving on to entrees. And to be honest, this trend, I don't even know if we can call it a trend anymore because it's really common. It's been going on for like a decade or better. We just love that kind of food. It's just kind of more interesting to write about than, say, an entree with a big piece of meat, your vegetable, and your starch. There's only, for writers, and particularly for food writers, and particularly for photographers, the small plates are something that we gravitate towards and we enjoy covering for those reasons.
And we learn in
we're
the
not pretending they're anything new.
Yeah. Well, we learn in the article, though, that chefs like it because can be more creative.
Yes, and they can change them, and they really lend themselves to changing with the seasons, bringing in locally sourced foods, as you'll see when you read it. You'll hear.
Give us some examples. Beet salads, I saw.
Oh, yes. Beets are very popular because beets are something that you get locally from farms because they can store them all year round. So even in the middle of winter, you can get local produce in the form of beets and carrots and those kinds of root vegetables. And they're so beautiful. I think you see mainly red beets in our stories, but as you know, there's red striped beets, there's orange beets, there's all different colors, and they have different flavors depending on how you cook them. So chefs love working with beets. They love working with carrots. And these aren't foods that maybe you and I, you know, gravitated to when we were kids, mm-hmm. but as adults, we're beginning to discover how interesting they can be.
And when we dine out, sometimes the portions are just so big. I mean, my wife always takes home a bag, always. And so this is a nice alternative for diners who might be looking for something that's good, but not overwhelming.
Well, and also you can try a couple things. You don't have to, if you pick one entree, there's no way, I'll try that other entree too. You're not going to do that. It's wasteful. And so this way you can have, with your wife, you could get three or four small plates, so you get to taste, rather than just two things from that restaurant, four things.
Good idea. I'm going to have to try that next time. Because, you know, I'm tempted to just have an appetizer for dinner on many occasions. I'm just not that hungry, and we're just out to be out and talk and enjoy the nightlife. But, you know,
well, especially if you're going to the theater or you're going on to a party or any other kind of event. It's really you don't want to have to go on and do other things and be active after a big, heavy meal.
I read with interest an article by contributor Jim Heaney of Investigative Post in the May issue, where he presents a story with former Buffalo News editor and now Washington Post media columnist Margaret Sullivan as a source who's warning of the threat to local journalism in the nation. What's under threat here?
Well, I mean, the impetus for that column is really the Pew study that came out, which I saw before this. I even knew that Jim was going to write about this. And it's really kind of depressing for newspaper people because it studied both locally. There was a Western New York part of it and then a national part of it. You're able to, when you go to it online, you're able to click on your area and to what percentage of the population is actually reading newspapers and how are they getting their news. And so few are getting their news from newspapers now. And that's really sad because it's frightening. It's not just sad because how are you going to get your local news if there isn't a newspaper in your town? You know, CNN or Fox News is not going to cover what's happening in Buffalo. You're not going to get that news anymore. And we think that people should care about that. Margaret Sullivan rightly thinks that people should care about that. So that's just, and it's also a question, as she points out and as others have pointed out, of holding public officials to account. No one's looking at them anymore if the newspaper's not. Now, of course, we're very lucky in Buffalo to have WBFO and the great radio news, local news coverage that you provide. But it's not enough. You know that you can't tell the whole story in a couple-minute radio or TV segment.
Yeah, but I still look at the news, and it has half the staff it once did, but I'm still reading Enterprise stories every Sunday. The reporters are still doing their job. TV news has some bright spots. Charlie Specht doing the clergy abuse scandal coverage on Channel 7, and the Investigative Post uncovered a story just this past week on a physician at Children's Hospital. So I'd like to think that we're trying to avoid the crisis, but what you're saying is it's okay now, but as people like your age, my age, as we get older and the people who are growing up aren't turning to
only
3%
of people under 20 are reading newspapers. That's not encouraging. I think the optimist side is you try to form new models. I mean, I think the WBFO model is a different model because you're doing it through public support and some other funding. And I think Investigative Post is also a 501c3. Mm-hmm. They're doing it through public funding. So if the idea is if all the advertisers go away, then you have to find new models to pay. And then to pay for that news, and of course the paywall is the other way. I pay for Buffalo News, Washington Post, and New York Times, and I'm happy to do so.
So do I. Those three, definitely. I mean, I just love my newspaper in the morning. Get a cup of coffee, put WBFO on the radio, and my newspaper, and life doesn't get any better.
I actually read mine online.
Do you?
And so and I think a lot of people are willing to pay for the privilege of reading the news. However, you don't have to have the physical paper, and when it comes to that, that's where it's going to end up because the big cost is printing.
I could easily give up the paper if the Buffalo News went
all
digital.
As long as you're getting the content.
Yeah, because the content's important.
It's a little different than magazines. You're not leafing through it for like the big color pictures and the double truck photo spreads and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Elizabeth, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Elizabeth Licata is editor of Buffalo Spree. Mark Scott, WBFO News.